Thank you, John. Very sweet. Thank you very much for that very kind introduction. It's such an honor to be here in Aggieland to give this eminent scholar lecture. And while John said many nice things, one of the nicest things I consider an award is getting to meet John and Eloise and Clifford and Judy and the other Hagler Fellows like you, Kyle. It's a real honor to be a Hagler Fellow, and I just feel very blessed and fortunate. So I'm really delighted to tell you today about something that has been on my mind and on my heart for about 20 years. And this topic is, while I'll focus on the information and communications technology field, that's what ICT stands for, information, computer, communications, technology, think of all the internet and the computers and your phone and the network and the fiber optics. While I'm going to focus at the end on what I think is a breakthrough result for that specific sector of the world, the first part of this talk is really a message that should resonate with us, and we should think about our family, our children, our children's children. Because in preparing this lecture, I dug deep into what's fact, what's fiction, what's the real data and the science and engineering behind the energy field and the consumption of energy on planet Earth. So my hope is that you take away from this lecture something that you remember and think about, because it will impact all of us for the rest of our lives and our generations to come after us. When you look at the history of energy consumption on planet Earth, it's pretty remarkable to think about. From the prehistoric days up until about the 1800s, planet Earth, all over, every country, consumed primarily biomass, wood, leaves. We burned wood, we burned foliage to create energy for heating, for cooking. And it wasn't until the 1820s, when the Industrial Revolution happened, and we discovered the steam engine, we discovered the locomotive, the telegraph was invented by Samuel Morse, the professor at NYU, who wanted to find a way to communicate when he tragically learned his wife had died and he was three states away. And so the telegraph was invented in the 1820s, 1830s. There was this Industrial Revolution, and for the first time ever in the history of mankind, there was a need to create energy which would allow machines, such as engines, to start doing work. And if you look, the Industrial Revolution, up until then, the consumption globally on planet Earth was about 5 terawatt hours of energy per year. Now, what's a terawatt hour? For those who aren't engineers, a terawatt is 12 zeros. It's a billion. It's a million. So a million 6 zeros. A million times a million is 12 zeros. So all over the planet in the 1800s, for an entire year, it took 5 terawatts, or 5 million watt-hours of energy. Now, to put that in perspective, our light bulb in a house, an incandescent light bulb sold by General Electric, is about 100 watts. If it burns for an hour, that's 100 watt-hour. And if it's a light-emitting diode light bulb, it's maybe 10 watts, so it's 10 watt-hours of energy. So planet Earth was consuming about 5 terawatt hours of energy for an entire year until the Industrial Revolution. We discovered oil in Pennsylvania in the late 1850s, railroads starting to be built, and you can see it took about a century, from 1800 to 1900, to go from 5 terawatt hours to 5,000 terawatt hours to 10,000 terawatt hours. Over 100 years, the energy consumption doubled. This was the start of automobiles. And now you can see around 1900, after the discovery of coal mining and the discovery of oil, we started to see the growth of the Industrial Revolution. And the rate of energy consumption on the planet really took off. And we went from 10,000 terawatt hours to 20,000 terawatt hours in about 50 years. And you can see that oil Texas oil, around 1900, big oil, really started to ramp as part of the global energy consumption. Coal, you can see, really was the primary source. Coal was the primary source throughout the 20th century, of early part of the 20th century, for energy production. And when I say primary energy, this is energy consumed in all sources, end users, manufacturing, producing goods, waste. It's the entire source of energy on planet Earth. And you can see natural gas, with the natural gas pipeline technology becoming improved in the 1920s, started the consumption of natural gas. So where we are today is, on planet Earth, we're consuming 180,000 terawatt hours per year. And look at the slope of the curve. If you look at the slope of the curve, it's starting to accelerate. What's very interesting is you can see the dips. Here you can see COVID, the dip of all energy sources around 2021. You can see the financial crisis in 2008. Or the, remember the days in the 1970s, those of you old enough, remember the shortages at the gas lines in the 1970s? You can see these dips in global energy supply. But there's no doubt that the energy consumption on planet Earth is increasing rapidly. In fact, it's doubled in 40 years. In 40 years, we've gone from about 90,000 terawatt hours to 180,000 terawatt hours. And you can see, while we have renewable energies, such as nuclear and hydropower, hydropower you can see is in blue, which is starting to grow, especially in developing nations. These renewable energy sources are very much a small part of the global energy consumption today. I want you to look at this tiny number in the upper left-hand column of the chart, 648 exajoules. That's the annual energy consumption of planet Earth, 648 exajoules. Say this with me, 648 exajoules, 648 exajoules. That's how much energy planet Earth is consuming. And how much is one exajoule? Well, one exajoule is one with 18 zeros of a joule, 10 to the 18th joules. One exajoule is 277.8 terawatt hours. We're consuming in a year about 650 of these. And what comes after exa is 10 to the 18th? Does anyone know? What's 10 to the 21st? Zeta. The global energy consumption is approaching one zeta joule a year, which is so much energy, it's hard to wrap your mind around it. Well, I became sensitive to this about 20 years ago when I moved to Texas. I loved moving to Texas, and I learned about the oil industry, and I saw the value it brought to the economy. It was pretty incredible. And I also was starting to look at the global population growth at that time. Now, this is, you might ask, why is the energy starting to grow exponentially? Why is our consumption growing exponentially? Well, one obvious reason would be population growth. And when you look at the global population growth in the last 40 years, where we've doubled from 90,000 terawatt hours to 180,000 terawatt hours, to get up to 650 exajoules, look at what's happened around the world in population. One of the remarkable things about the population growth is you see Africa is the continent which is growing at the fastest rate. The population has tripled from 500 million to 1.5 billion people in the last 40 years. India, similarly, has doubled in the last 40 years from about 750 million to 1.5 billion people. Look at the bottom two, Japan and Russia. Pretty much flat population at about 120, 150 million over the last 40 years. But there's no argument that India, Africa, and Asia, minus Japan, China, and India, are growing very rapidly. China's growth, population growth, has increased from a little over a billion to about 1.4 billion. So if you look at the rapidly growing places of the world, you see it's not Europe population, not so much USA, certainly not Japan and Russia. You see it's in Asia and it's in Africa. So you'd expect that's where the energy growth would be, right? And this shows, if you look at the highlighted parts of the map of the world as it gets darker from the left to the right, we're going 40 years. You can see, sure enough, US, China, even Australia, South America, they're all consuming more energy. And you can see that hydroelectric is really big in South America. They've made big investments in hydroelectric energy. Africa really started to get ahead of its energy needs by creating this unified front with the Economic Community of West African States, which was aimed at helping to grow the economies, reduce conflicts. It hasn't gotten to East Africa. East Africa needs that, where there's lots of battles still. But Western Africa really helped build its economy by creating an establishment, ECOWAS, to allow cooperation and energy policies. China really opened up, and you're going to see on the next slide how dramatic the growth in China has been. It's alarming. And India launched new economic policies to try to integrate its industry and its economy with its growing energy needs, with its doubling of population in 40 years. And meanwhile, Europe and Japan adopted energy curtailing policies. That is, there were government regulations on efficiency of vehicles, mile per gallon targets, and clean energy initiatives, and government subsidies. Europe and America have been leading the way in trying to curtail energy consumption and become more efficient, while the emerging nations have really been growing and coming onto the world stage, primarily China and India. And this is where you see how dramatic it is on the government policy and the focus on energy and how it's going to impact all of us over the next decades. This graph on the left shows the primary energy consumption in exajoules. Look on the left. Here we have exajoules, and you can see here's USA and Europe in green and blue. America's blue, USA's green. You can see over the last 40 years, Europe and America really have kept their annual energy consumption roughly the same. Our populations have grown slowly, and the whole world has evolved with much greater energy needs, yet Europe and America, through various policies and efficiencies, have kept their energy consumption per year in exajoules. You add all these up, you get about 650 exajoules. It's the world consumption per year. But you can see China. China in the 2000s started to become a huge energy consumer. In fact, right now, one of every watt burned on planet Earth is due to China. They have about one-fifth of the population. They have about one-fourth of the energy consumption, and it's been an incredible rise. Similarly, look at India. India's in purple. While it's at a much lower level, it's starting to begin ramping its energy consumption. India has about one-fifth of the global population. It's certainly not consuming one-fifth of the energy, but that's coming. That's coming as India's economic reforms start to ramp. And so there's this conflict, there's this tension evolving about energy policy and consumption. And here you can see a mapping to carbon dioxide emissions. Now, there's a very strong correlation between energy consumption and carbon dioxide. Carbon dioxide is a greenhouse gas, methane is a greenhouse gas. Greenhouse gases are good. They're emitted by photosynthesis by plants. They keep this wonderful troposphere, this incredible part of the atmosphere from Earth's up to about 10 kilometers above Earth. This troposphere keeps us safe from galactic radiation from space. It keeps us safe from other sources of energy. It also keeps us well insulated and allows Earth to sustain life because our temperatures are reasonable. They're not sub-zero as they are in deep space. Too much greenhouse gases creates more of a carbon dioxide layer, which keeps more heat trapped in. And so The concern has been over the last 3 decades that as energy consumption has been growing, that the temperature may rise because of the carbon dioxide that's in the troposphere. In fact, hard data, science, shows that when you look at ice crystals captured and with carbon dating, you can track back to thousands and thousands of years, going back to 800,000 years. If you look at the average amount of carbon dioxide found that was on planet Earth and compare it to today's levels, there is no arguing that carbon dioxide now is 250 times more than it was in the industrial age. So there's hard science shows that there is more carbon dioxide. And when you look at the different energy sources on planet Earth to figure out how much carbon dioxide is produced by a source, you see that coal is the biggest offender in producing carbon dioxide at about a kilogram per kilowatt hour of energy. Oil is 840, natural gas is 486. Renewables are much lower. So renewable energy produces less carbon dioxide. Now, this has all been politicized over the last couple of decades, and sadly, the hard science gets missed. There is no doubt that the temperature is rising. Now, we use the term climate change as a politically neutral term. If we say climate change, there's no argument the climate's changing, temperature's going up. But if we use the term global warming, that has sadly been politicized. Global warming has been politicized. It's true that the average temperature of Earth is going up, but the term global warming is kind of ascribes a human element, a human part of it, and climate change is basically an observation, a scientific observation. So in the scientific literature, I think we're safer using the term climate change. Certainly we have cold days and we have hot days, and no one was alive in 1800, but the carbon dating shows that indeed there's more carbon dioxide, and because of carbon dioxide, we can make a strong correlation. Correlation is not necessarily causation, but there is a correlation that more carbon dioxide leads to higher temperatures. But we like to use the term climate change. So let's look at who's using what around the world to get to this 648 exajoules of energy consumption, and it's pretty remarkable. What sticks out at you at coal? Look at coal. That's almost 100 exajoules. About 15% of every watt consumed on planet Earth is from China in coal. So this is a real fact that coal, which was the most heavily producing carbon dioxide source of energy, is coming from China. And you can see other countries are reliant on coal. The second most reliant country on coal, you can see, is, coal is China, and then coal, the U.S. is, U.S., we've really reduced our coal. You can see that India is the second most reliant country on coal, the dirtiest, if you will, the most carbon dioxide producer. And you look at the United States in blue, our coal is way down, but oil, we're a big consumer of oil, but we're at about 35 exajoules, which is about the same amount of energy being consumed in renewables in China. So you can see China's making a move. They're so big, they're making a move in renewable energy. And this is what governments around the world need to encourage. We need to encourage a more moderate and balanced approach because the energy consumptions are only going to go up. What's interesting is if you look at the United States, USA is moving to renewable energy and coal, or renewable and clean energy rather. You can see the US is there. Europe's ahead of the US in adoption. US uses a lot of natural gas. We use a lot of natural gas, which is half the producer of oil in terms of carbon dioxide. Europe does not use so much natural gas. So this was fascinating to see where the energy is used. So there's a lot of pressure from world governments to try to encourage the rapidly growing economies, China, India, to try to use the policies that Europe and the U.S. have used for the last several decades to moderate the energy consumption, that is, to pay more attention to energy efficiency. In fact, here's some of the examples. In 1995, the world established through the United Nations something called the COP, the Conference of the Parties, to address this issue of climate change. And you probably read in the papers right around Christmas time last year how there was a big blow-up by some of the smaller Asian countries being upset and walking away from the table because they wanted money, they wanted restitution to be able to improve their quality of life, to deal with their need to make their energy more efficient because of the energy issues coming from the large countries that were creating more carbon emissions. They wanted $1.3 trillion. They were offered $300 billion. They were upset. This made the headlines. But they've been working on this for 30 years. So this is a real issue, and it's going to become more of an issue over time. But at least they're talking to try to resolve. So when you look at how energy is consumed across the industries of the world, you realize that about 30% of that 650 exajoules per year, 30% goes into waste, manufacturing of goods, creating plastics, doing what's needed to create goods that we consume. The actual consumption of human beings and the things we operate and use, machines, on planet Earth is that bottom line, 445 exajoules, about 70% of the global consumption. And so I wanted to look at what I could do as a communications engineer, a circuit designer, someone who's in the ICT field. I wanted to see where we are and where our industry is going so we can start doing our part to try to slow down this inevitable growth in consumption of energy. And as I looked at the industries, I was amazed to see that cars, road vehicle cars, are 20% of the global end user consumption of energy. 1 in 5 watts that we actually get to end users are used in vehicles. And aviation is just about 2%. You can see the percentage of the consumption share. 19% of the world, roughly 1 in 5 of the world energy consumptions in residential buildings, in our houses. And so my industry, our industry, if you're a double E, and Professor Junkins introduced me as a geek, and I want to say to all of you who are double E's, you can't be a geek without double E. And so in my field, I'm at 4.1%. We are at 4.1% of consuming the world's energy. This is a couple years ago. We're probably approaching 5%, and you're going to see we're about to go to 15 and 20%. Our industry is going to go, number one, because of the growth of bandwidth, computers, AI, GPUs. I'm going to talk about that. But number two, because as we get more into the information society, we're going to start decreasing this roads and vehicle and aviation. This will be, we'll be able to chip away at that and bring it more into the ICT industry. We saw that with the remoting during COVID. So ICT industry is at about 4.1%. And remember, 1 exajoule is about 277 terawatt hours. So user devices are 2 exajoules. This is about 2 exajoules of the 650 exajoules around the world, just in our phones, our laptops, the things we carry around to communicate. The network, the infrastructure, is about 1 exajoule, 272 terawatt hours. So 1 exajoule is in the network, the base stations, the cellular towers, the fiber optic cables, the switches, and then the data centers, which is growing very rapidly, is about 1 exajoule of the 650 used around the world in all aspects. So we're a significant part, the ICT industry is a significant part of the energy consumption. And what's amazing is if you look at the R&D budgets of the over-the-top providers like Facebook, Meta, Google, YouTube, Microsoft, Amazon, the people that provide the infrastructure, their investment in the ICT industry is greater than the entire oil and gas industry of the United States. And it's also greater than the federal government of the U.S. That's before the election, so you can imagine it's going to go down. The point is, the investment of the ICT industry to get faster, better, more reliable, more intelligent computation is starting to escalate in incredible scale, hyper-exponential, as you'll see. So we're looking at an ICT industry that right now is about 4 or 5%. We're going to see it go to 20% very soon. And let me give you a dramatic example of how radical the AI adoption is. This is from one of the chief economists at BlackRock who spoke at our Brooklyn 6G summit when AI had just come out, ChatGPT had just been announced, and he looked at how long it took for popular apps to reach 1 million users. And you can see from this chart, and this is from a couple years ago at our Brooklyn 6G summit, you can see it took Netflix 3.5 years to reach 1 million users for video streaming. It took Twitter 2 years, Facebook 10 months to reach 1 million users, Instagram 2.5 months, ChatGPT 5 days. Think about that. 5 days to reach 1 million users after ChatGPT was announced. And that's the tip of the iceberg. In fact, this estimate is already old. It's from last year, and it's so far below prediction. Goldman Sachs was predicting, based on historical records from 2014 to 2023, what they estimated the rest of the world and U.S. AI global consumption to be. And they showed in 2030 it reaching 1,000 terawatt hours, which is about 4 exajoules in 2030. That's already way low. We're going to be 5 exajoules, maybe 6 exajoules. And remember, 6 exajoules out of 650, that's 1% of the world's global energy consumption. That's just in the U.S. for AI. And this is old. So there's what you could call an energy consumption tidal wave or energy consumption tsunami starting to hit our planet, and AI is going to be a big part of it. By the way, it takes 2.9 watt hours. This is old data. They've gotten more efficient, and the new NVIDIA chips that they're installing would be more efficient, but 2.9 watt hours to make one request to ChatGPT. How many people are using AI of some sort in this room? Raise your hand. Okay, look at that. Virtually everyone. Virtually everyone. Every time you make one query, 2.9 watt hours, a third of an LED light bulb. Right? Now think about it. 9 billion queries daily consumes 10 watt hours. We're doing much more than that now. You're writing code. You're doing images. Those are making dozens, hundreds, thousands of queries. I was in a meeting earlier today where we're running simulations on room structures and radio waves, and that's probably making millions of queries, taking 20 hours to run. The point is, this is an energy consumption tsunami, so that you now see in the papers that the large hyperscalers are starting to buy nuclear reactors, are trying to get access to nuclear reactors. 3 Mile Island, Waynesboro, Georgia. The nuclear reactor industry, the small nuclear reactor industry, is starting to grow big stock price valuations because of the huge need. And this is just the start. You can see that right now around the country, the large companies that provide the infrastructure for cloud computing, edge computing, AI, are starting to locate their data centers near natural gas ports, near the big supply places of the natural gas pipelines. They're moving close to nuclear reactors. They're building out their infrastructure as close as they get to large energy consumption supply places, and that's going to continue and accelerate. So, I said I started thinking about that this in 20 years ago when I came to Texas, and I looked at our industry, the wireless industry of which I'm a part, and I looked at the state of the art in data centers, which were just starting to become popular in the early 2000s. In the early 2000s, we still didn't have a smartphone in our hand. And it was really the early days of the internet. But it was very clear that there'd be more and more data consumed and more energy consumed. And the provost of Berkeley, Randy Katz, was a very good computer engineering researcher, wrote a wonderful paper called Tech Titans Building Boom around 2002 in IEEE Spectrum. And I knew Randy from a DARPA project, and I called him. I said, this is really a powerful paper. Look it up, Tech Titans Building Boom. And he talked about the waste and the heat in the early data centers. That paper influenced me, just like I hope this talk influences you. And it really brought energy efficiency to my mind. And as I looked at circuits, and there wasn't even AIML back then, but as I looked at everything we do in our field, there was not a fundamental metric by which everyone could compare energy consumption in their designs. It shocked me. Now, we can measure energy in joule, that's a standard. We can measure power consumed in watts, that's a standard. But if you looked at different ways of designing circuits or networks, there was no fundamental energy efficiency metric that everyone could get around and agree, that's a standard. And if you can't standardize and measure, you can't improve. And so if you look at the standard bodies today, this is a look at the mobile radio industry. ETSI is the European telecom standard body. On the right is their metric for energy efficiency for the network. ITU is the International Telecom Union. That's their energy efficiency for a base station site. ETSI has another standard for the base station. And then there's the RF side. That's the mobile unit. So it has all these different metrics, all these different values. They're all disparate. They all mean different things. You can play around with the numbers and get very different energy efficiency metrics for whatever sector of the industry you're in. Very convenient. 3GPP has some idea of rough, vague idea of some useful target. But the bottom line, there isn't a fundamental metric that everyone can use and design and compare and start taking ownership of being efficient. In fact, look at the data center industry. The data center industry uses something called PUE, Power Usage Effectiveness. And if you go to the Wikipedia page, they'll admit this is not the best unit of measure, but it's the measure we use for building data centers. Data centers are huge consumers. Exajoule of power we saw on the edge, going to 2 exajoules. Big part of the global supply, and we don't have a really good metric. In fact, if you look at 2 data centers with particular energy usages of different sizes, you get the same PUE value. The unit of metric, the power user efficiency for 2 data centers are 1.833. So you'd think very happily if you're a Google or an Amazon, I'm good. You know, I'm comparable to the rest of the industry with this metric. Move on. Burn some more fossil fuel or clean energy, whatever you want to call it. And even in circuit design, I'm really glad Cameron's here and some of his students. I'm very excited. I've always been excited about circuits. When I was a master's student, I worked at Harris Corporation and built an amplifier that actually flew in a satellite. So I've always loved circuits. It was a gallium arsenide RF front end or power amp. But if you look at the circuits industry, how we measure energy efficiency of the circuit is the basic fundamental building block of everything we use in electronics. You need a circuit to do anything. So it's the fundamental level. That's where we really need to get energy efficiency rooted, because if you can do fundamental circuit design with energy efficiency, it all bubbles up. Yet you look at the circuit field and there's no fundamental metric for energy efficiency. I have a different metric for an amplifier than I do for a low noise amplifier. One's on a transmitter, one's on a receiver. Look, they all consume power. Why don't we have a single metric? In fact, you look at IEEE, they're starting yet another standard body in 2023 for the International Network Generations Roadmap for energy efficiency. So you have everyone talking about energy efficiency, yet we don't have a fundamental metric. What's an academic to do? So I've watched this happening for 20 years. I've been worried about the planet. Now, I don't know what you do when you get off time. This might be a little bit of a tell about who I am. But when you get a couple days off and you're at the beach and you've turned your phone off, I hope you all have turned your phone off. Not only is it energy efficient, it's peaceful. What do you do? Well, I love to read a good novel. It's very rare these days, but I love to just get lost in the novel. But one thing I do about every 10 years is I pull out the classic papers that have created my field. I go to the papers from the 1940s that have influenced the entire field of information theory and the entire field of wireless. I read the original papers from Bell Labs of my heroes. In fact, the heroes I read about are the paper by Weaver and Shannon, right before Shannon figured out information theory, and I read about Harold Freese. So Weaver and Shannon were at Bell Labs pioneering the idea of communications in the 1930s, 1940s. And the only form of digital communication in those days was the Morse code, the telegraph, which Samuel Morse invented at the beginning of the Industrial Revolution. It's digital. That's CQ, like I'm seeking you. And you can talk in Morse code. So their research, before Shannon came up with information theory, was on studying a Morse code channel in noise. Weaver and Shannon, if you look at their papers, and I read them once every 10 years, are about studying the idea of digital information before there was ever any computers or digital information. And Harold Freese figured out how much energy is wasted from a transmitter to a receiver, and he invented something fundamental that every circuit designer knows about, called noise figure. See, Harold Freese and Claude Shannon built the fundamental metric that built the entire computer and communications digital revolution. They did the fundamental metric. In this paper, Claude Shannon, in 1948, invented the idea of the mathematical theory of communication, which led to the field of information theory. He considers individual alphabets or messages that are stochastically or randomly produced from a source, digitized. In fact, you can see he uses the idea entropy, which came from the law of thermodynamics and Boltzmann. Boltzmann, 40 years earlier, developed Boltzmann's constant and came up with the statistical idea of how atoms and molecules move randomly to form the state space of elements. This is before the discovery of the electron by Rutherford in 1910. So this is early stuff. But these Bell Labs people went back to their heroes. They went and read the papers of their heroes to learn about entropy, and through entropy, he discovered, using the idea of Boltzmann and entropy, created the mathematics, which are really very simple. This is not a hard equation. It's not hard, but he created the framework to have the most fundamental measure of information, a standard that the whole world could grab around, and that fundamental metric was the bit. The binary digit. He broke every piece of information down into an individual fundamental metric that the whole world could build the whole computer and communications industry around. The bit. In fact, Harold Freese did the same thing for radio receivers. Back in the 1930s, 1940s, we didn't have digital modulation or computers or cell phones. Everything was over the air, ionospheric, static. You see it in the old movies. He came up with a fundamental way, again going back to Boltzmann 50 years earlier, reading Boltzmann's paper, came up with a fundamental way to characterize noise coming into a receiver. And then if a noise came into the receiver, that noise would add up through the components out to your headphones where you'd hear it. He came up with a systematic, fundamental, basic way, a basic standard to measure noise in a receiver. And that was the noise figure or noise factor, which every circuit designer does use only in receivers, pretty much. Because you're interested in the additive noise to the signal noise ratio. So I read these papers every 10 years. And I'd read them in 2010, and so I was on the lookout for a student who'd want to work on this, and I found this great student at UT Austin named James Murdoch in 2011, and he wanted to build a perpetual motion machine. He was just such a genius. And I said, this is great, James. Go off and do what you want. It was a first semester master's student. I just wanted him to know a way around the halls and where the bathroom is and make friends. And he came back and he had studied the perpetual motion machine and realized you can't have a swinging pendulum work forever because there's losses. There's energy loss. And there's gravitational forces. But he had learned a lot about it. And then he wanted to do a Turing machine. A computer that didn't consume power. And so he went off for a few weeks and did that. And after he had his fun, I said, look, James, energy efficiency is going to be really important, and there's no fundamental metric for consuming energy in a communication system. And he loved that problem. And so I had him read the papers by Shannon and by Fries, and he came back with this idea of a consumption factor. And he did a lot of math, and in the math, he figured out some formulas, and it looked surprisingly like Harold Fries' noise figure equation, cascaded system with additive noise, but now you're just additing the power waste as a signal goes from source to sink. In 2014, we published this paper, and then industry just started to look at it. And here was the idea. The idea was simple, just like Shannon or just like Fries, which is you have a source on the left, a message source, and then you have a sink, a receiver on the right. And you have all these components which are going to be consuming power that carry the signal. And then you have all the off-signal path devices, things that don't consume power for the transmission but are needed to support the transmission. Think of your cell phone. The cell phone's got your microphone. That's the source, or your keypad. And then you've got the circuits in there that go all the way to the power amplifier and the antenna. Those are the on-signal path components. And then you have the off-signal path devices, kind of like your screen, your display, heat sinks, charging circuits. They don't get the information across, but they're needed for support. By breaking down any circuit, any system, into these disparate, independent energy sources, we developed our theory. And this had always been overlooked. People did not break down the components which carry the signal versus don't carry the signal. But when you start doing that, you can start to get a fundamental metric that allows everyone to understand energy cost in transmission. And we did some theory and made some notes, and we also were able to use the Shannon limit of capacity theory to bring in Shannon's idea of the bit to be able to show the most efficient way, energy efficient way, to build a source to sink system. This was very exciting, but the math was very cumbersome. It wasn't elegant enough. Nokia tried to use it with one of my grad students, and thanks to the Hagler Fellow collaboration, working with Sabit and his student, we were able to find that this paper actually has a math error in this equation. So we're now working on a paper to clean this up, and maybe we'll gain more adoption. I would not have found it. I had published it. It was 6 years away. But a Hagler Fellow supported graduate student found this error, and we're now writing a paper to kind of improve this. But they used it for high altitude. And then finally, I had a group of students. I said, look, this is a major issue. I showed them these graphs. I said, we've got to get this theory digestible by the world. The world needs this fundamental idea. And so we published two papers last year on waste figure and waste factor. We renamed it, recast the math to look identical to the Bell Labs Journal of 1944 so that it's very accessible. Everyone in a communications textbook who learns noise figure, I'm hoping will soon learn waste figure, because we need this figure of merit to be able to compare circuit designs, to compare data center designs, to design, to compare anything that has a source to a sink in communication. Here's the math. I won't spend a lot of time on it, but it's very simple. W, this new figure of merit, which I like to think is like the bit in information theory, which I like to think is noise figure for noise. But now this is the fundamental metric for power consumption or energy efficiency. Think of this as the energy efficiency metric. It's simply the total power consumed along a communications path divided by the power output from that path. A very simple definition. It's basically the total power needed to get information in a system divided by the actual power that's in the information itself. Think about it, it's 1 over efficiency. It's 1 over efficiency. And W, when defined this way, is always greater than 1. So this very simple definition, describing any circuit or any system that has information in and out, being the total power consumed to get it there, divided by the total power out, is the definition of waste figure. And when you do that, you now have a figure of merit that's very much like noise figure for receiver noise, but now it's for power consumed. And the beauty is the math is exactly the same as Frees' noise figure, except instead of referring to the input noise at the antenna of a receiver, the most important power consumption part is at the output of the cascade, where you have the biggest, the power amplifier, or the biggest loss, the radio channel, or the fiber optic cable, or the loss in the ohmic cables. So now we have shown that this waste factor is very elegantly described by the waste factor of each circuit divided by the gains of the circuit. Very simple, very elegant, but very powerful. And so in 1944, by reading my heroes every 10 years and getting inspired, we came up with, just like Harold Frees at Bell Labs in 44 did his noise factor, we have waste factor for any cascaded network referred to the cascade output. And the beauty is it works in circuits, it works in systems, it works in computer centers. Look at this. This is a simple attenuator used in circuits to get impedance matching or load balancing. The waste factor of an attenuator is, if you look at the math and the definition, it's simply equal to the loss, which is identical to Harold Frees' noise figure, their noise factor, where the noise factor of an attenuator is equal to its loss. So here, the attenuator waste factor is equal to the noise attenuator. And now you can start doing designs. Here's an example of a Homodyne transmitter, a very low-cost transmitter that you might have in an IoT. And I went to the specs of different components sold by Minicircuits, which is a big electronics supplier. And if you look at the amplifier, mixer, and baseband for different cases, you can now start using the waste factor to accurately describe the power efficiency of this circuit, of this transmitter. In fact, if you can see here, if you pick a more efficient RF amplifier, which is closest to the sink, that is, that's going to be the most critical element in this formula. If you pick a more efficient RF amplifier, you get a lower waste figure. You want the waste figure to be 1 or 0 dB. So driving this number small means more power efficiency, better for the planet. We now have a fundamental metric by which we can measure, compare, characterize any system. And here's what's amazing. It works for wired systems and wireless systems because the gain of a channel, the loss between a transmitter and receiver, is simply 1 over the gain. So you can treat the wireless channel as simply a block in the cascade from source to sink. So it works for wired and wireless, computer wireless communications. In fact, the waste of the channel is going to be a very high waste factor because of free space propagation equation, radio waves spread out, and so you capture very little bit of the energy. So the waste factor of a channel, just like an attenuator, is the loss of the channel. It's just like an attenuator. And then thirdly, there's this very elegant situation in most wireless systems when the gain of the receiver is less than the path loss of the channel. Deep space satellite, you might lose 170 dB. You might only have 100 dB in the receiver. So this is very typical. And when you have a cascaded system with a channel which is much lossier than the gain of the receiver, this equation simplifies so easily to just this equation. So we now have a way to look at multi-user cellular networks with knowing the channel loss to figure out the power efficiency of architectures for cellular networks. MIMO systems, antennas, base stations. Do you use a relay? Do you use a repeater? Do you not use a repeater? We have very elegant formula using this fundamental metric of power efficiency down to the basic level. In fact, now look at circuit design. Remember I told you circuit design has these different definitions for LNAs and PAEs? Well, here, waste factor is a unifier. It unifies all the metrics for different circuit configurations to be characterized as a waste factor or waste figure. So the waste factor is simply 1 over the original PAE definition, or it's simply 1 over PAE and the power of the DC and the input and the gains. So waste figure can be the unifier for all these different circuit metrics. Finally, I want to show this data center because data centers are huge consumers. Remember I showed you that the current metric would say these two data centers are equally efficient in energy? Take a look at this. When you get into that and you break the data center into the components which carry information, the computer information in the data center, versus the components that are not used in the data center communication path, look what you find. you find that the information power and the non-information power, when you break it down, you could recast the power PUE into waste factor. And when you look at the non-path, cooling, lighting, power conversion, and you break the components down into their base level of energy consumption, guess what? It turns out that this data center B is actually not as efficient as data center A. They're not the same in energy efficiency. The bigger data center, even though it consumes more energy, it's more efficient in carrying information. So the industry is totally missing the fact that their design of their data centers could carry carry information and therefore be more energy efficient at what they do. Right now they think they're the same, but they're wasting a lot of power. This smaller energy consumption looks appealing, but it's got a higher waste factor, which means more of that energy is being burnt into stuff that's not doing the job of that device. So let's just finalize with an example that Huawei, of all the companies, Huawei is the one that's jumped on this. I'm trying to get all my other companies interested. Huawei sees the value. They're trying to standardize it in ITU. Here's an example of two base stations, a 5G base station, and by the way, give Huawei credit. They see the value in this. There's 5G base station in green, 4G base station in red. If you use the energy efficiency formula from ITU, you see that the two base stations have equivalent energy. When you use the waste factor to characterize the energy being used to transmit information from the base station, what you find is about a 15% improvement by using the 5G base station. It may cost more in terms of power because it's got more bandwidth. It's doing more work. But the cellular carriers don't know this. They just see a higher utility bill. By the way, AT&T pays about $2 billion a year in utility. But they would be getting more data throughput at lower cost per bit using waste factor, because here you can see we have a waste factor of 3 rather than 3.5. In fact, today's metrics used by the entire wireless industry are dependent on the actual data load at any instant of time. So as the data load goes up and down at night, not many cell phone users, day a lot of cell phone users, rush hour, their metrics are clouding the efficiency. Waste factor is independent of time because it pulls out the information flow from the non-information. So you get an actual metric of the energy efficiency of the device doing work. So looking at it to drive use cases for installation of future wireless networks, the optimal case is to have a low waste factor and to have a very high data rate. That's optimal. If all the cellular networks did this, we could make the ICT industry much more energy efficient. We're not doing that now. We don't have metrics to do it. On the bottom left, it's low waste factor, which is good, but the data rate's low. So all we need to do is up the transmitter power or up the bandwidth, because we already have good low waste factor. We're already designed well for carrying information efficiency. In the upper right, this is a good case, but it's very wasteful. Power domain energy, that allows you to get, that tells you you need to replace the radio unit with a smaller waste factor. This is what 4G is doing today. It's getting good data rate, but they're spending a lot of money for it. And then here, this is the worst case situation. It still happens a lot. High waste factor and low data rate. And the waste factor is the first metric that instructs you how to design the network. So we published this in a paper last year called Waste Factor and Waste Figure, a unified theory for modeling and analyzing wasted power in radio access networks. But it applies to circuits. It applies to data centers. It's needed for the industry to be able to start focusing on how to do true energy efficient design. So let me conclude by saying we're facing an energy consumption tidal wave. There's no doubt about it. And you could go back and look at those curves to see how it's scaling. We lack a standard figure of merit for energy. But just like Fries went to the fundamentals of noise, and just like Shannon went back to the fundamentals of Boltzmann and statistical modeling of the natural atoms and molecules, We need to go down to the basic fundamentals, the basic law of physics, and that's what we've tried to do with waste figure. It's based on a natural law of energy consumption and the characterization of energy. It doesn't abstract, it goes to the base root at each component. That's what waste figure does. Just like Shannon's bit went down to the basic, if you will, the unit vector of information. And with that, I want to thank you.
Great job. Questions?
Yes.
I
see my,
sorry. Say this, right?
Go ahead.
Does the strength of the source affect in a linear way, or is it like a concave or convex or something?
Thank you, Clifford. Clifford asked a great question. He asked about the strength of the source, the power of the source. How does that impact waste figure and power consumption? Bottom line is, the assumption here is linearity throughout. So we're assuming a linear system. So just like Harold Fries did, we're assuming linearity. Because of linearity, it doesn't matter what your power level is. More power transmitted will consume more power, but it doesn't change the waste figure. That last graph that showed the flat versus the curve is how it's done today, where it would matter. People would think that the power consumed by the amplifier changes the efficiency. If the system's linear through all the operating ranges, the waste factor stays the same, and it's a solid metric.
But is that an assumption, or is it a result?
It's a result. It's a result of the analysis, and Huawei actually measured their base stations to get one of those curves. As long as the device or system or circuit is linear, then waste factor is constant.
Right.
Yep. Yeah. Yeah, Narasimha. Yes.
Microphone.
It's a very good point.
Okay. So instead of getting into the politics of this, you may just want to abstract away the countries and just show total consumption of the world.
That's a very good point. While we see the rapid growth in China and India, the population of America is about a fourth or a fifth of those countries. So on a per capita, the U.S. is consuming more energy. Right, 25%. But if you look at the carbon dioxide emissions from the consumption of energy, the energy is much more efficiently consumed in America and the U.S. because of the governmental regulations to try to reduce the greenhouse gases.
Carbon dioxide emissions are still higher than those countries.
You're right. Per capita, it will still be
right.
Higher.
So I don't think, instead of politicizing that,
yes,
you know, country versus, I think it'll be just probably good to take away the data from the countries and show the consumption as the whole world.
It's a fair point.
Right.
It's
okay.
A fair point, because we are, U.S. and Europe is consuming and producing more CO2 per capita. That's very true.
The second point I want to make, the data centers are trying to get to what you're getting to as well. The fusion factor is trying to measure what is actually going into keeping the IT systems running versus cooling and the lighting and everything else. And in fact, they're even trying to measure the losses in energy. You know, if you get 11 kilovolts line, by the time you bring it down to 110 volts, they're trying to measure the losses as well.
Right, you've lost 5%.
Right. So your measure may be more accurate, a better measure, but they are trying to get to the similar.
They're trying to. But the problem with PUE, and right, you should take this to the community,
right,
the problem with PUE is they're missing the fact that if you break out the power consumed by the components that transfer the information, which is the job,
right,
versus the ancillary power, right, you're missing that totally in the PUE.
Right.
And so you're losing 15% of an exajoule. So maybe you can take this to the community. I've broached it to a couple of people. They bristle. You know, I report, you decide. But the bottom line is it needs to be down at that granular level, or we're not going to make the fundamental breakthroughs to do the metrics to get a hold of this.
Yeah, so the only point I was making is that the data center guys are paying attention.
Yeah. Well, maybe they could look at waste factor. I think you could help them. Because they're still using PUE, as far as I know.
Yeah, are
they?
They are.
That's okay, right. Yeah. My case is made. Anyone? Yes.
It seems like this is a very methodical approach to coming up with this idea.
Yeah. So you saw in prior works that very, very accomplished researchers went back to what you called the unit vector of some problem. By going back to the unit vector, we were able to come up with some fundamental law, I would almost say, for this problem. This is a little bit abstracted, but as a lot of research gets increasingly black box with the implementation of LLMs, AI, and we start moving away from known truths or known laws, how do you foresee that affecting future research when it comes to moving back to how older researchers used to work with
these? Thank you for that question. The question, bottom line is, will we lose the fundamentals? Will we be able to go back to the fundamental natural laws as AI starts to formulate solutions without any basis of that or without necessarily utilizing any of that thought process? It's a great question. I tell my students when I lecture, the biggest challenge you will face in your careers is determining what's true and what's not. That's going to be your biggest challenge and your most responsible job for the planet and for the future. And you can learn a lot from the human thought process, and it's probably a debate, will computers ever be able to do that and put that into their thinking? I'm not going to debate that. I don't think that will ever happen. But I would take away the fact that you always need to think about going back to fundamental principles. We had Srinivasan and I had a meeting with some of his students today, and one of the AI models wasn't considering the propagation distance and just making it up, and one was using that, and we all agreed it's better to use a fundamental model to start the training of the data with a fundamental physical known fact. It's going to be more likely to be right, and at least you'll have more to use. I would encourage everyone in your life and in your work to always try to find the root truth and the fundamental issues that launched something. And in our field, it's usually 50 years before, maybe 100 years before, it finds normal use.
I have a couple questions.
Sure.
You can call. Thank you, Jess.
You're welcome.
Many of the systems you have are predominantly linear, but the theory must extend in some way to nonlinear. Nonlinearities, but there are a lot of nonlinear circuits around in the other systems. So how do you think about the role of extending this theory to accommodate nonlinear subsystems in your cascading?
Well, just like Harold Fries dealt with nonlinear systems in noise figure, you can linearize. You have a linearized model, or you look at it in a linear case, and then you extrapolate and estimate with linear estimators. I have not looked at that in detail.
Ancillary question. You know, one of the problems with the probability theory is it's so damn random, right? So when you're putting in noise figures and representing the elements in your linear system, the role that uncertainty plays in your analysis, how do you accommodate uncertainty over and above the input noise and the output noise?
Yes. The noise of the power efficiency. Yeah, you have to model that probabilistically.
Yeah.
And Harold Fries took care of that in his noise figure. We talk about a little bit how to do that in our paper. But the basic, you have a model, a statistical model, and you're able to basically come up with a mean and a standard deviation on the waste factor. But you can certainly still use it as a parameter.
And if you look at the distribution of power laws, not simply the uncertainty in it, but for example, the cooling of the circuit, possibly the largest element in many designs.
Yeah.
And that's important.
Right. And that's right. No, you've identified a key point. This theory only covers, and this goes to your point, and this is a really ripe area for exploration. While I've produced a fundamental metric for the power consumed or energy consumed from a source to a sink. I didn't address optimizing the if you will, non-signal path.
Yes.
And I believe you could use this same approach in modified form to study the efficiency of those components. Or maybe there's another theory that can be used for the non-signal components, and then you sum them up. That is a ripe area for study, and I don't think we have a way of optimizing the non-signal components. This is a start. It's for the signal flow.
Yeah.
But you're right. There's a lot of energy consumed in the ancillary.
I have one more question and a comment.
This is my defense. He's my major professor. I'm on the hot seat.
I
love it. He loves it. I'm sweating.
Why aren't we putting data centers in Greenland and Alaska and so on? Because they can be anywhere and possible. Why are we taking advantage of the environment to help us with cooling?
Well, as Narasimha mentioned, the loss in transporting power is not insignificant.
Yeah, okay.
It can be 5%. Yeah, they want them next to power plants because that's where the infrastructure is. And water. Water is cooling. So there's a lot of hydro locations.
I have an idea for you that might be worth something.
That's more homework for me as the grad student.
I think this idea really needs to be publicized. I really see a lot of beauty in what you've done. And I think my layman's title wrap-up for this is More Power to You.
Thank you. Thank you, John.
Good job.
Thank you very much. And
I have a presentation here for you. We have a little item to go with your collection of items to decorate your bookcase. And this is just a memento of this occasion. Congratulations on
thank
beautiful,
you.
Beautiful record.
Thank you. Thank you, John. And thank you all very much. I hope it was informative. I take your point very well, and I see the defensiveness fairly, because I gave this talk at GlobeCom, at the Global Communications Conference, for the first time, and I put a lot of research into this. And I got a lot of bristling, and I don't mean this to be defensive. It is a very fair point that the total amount of energy consumed by population is probably a factor of 3 to 4 greater by Europe and U.S. per population. I just want to point out the delta of energy consumption of the last 40 years. Europe and the U.S., imperfect as we are, has tried to keep the energy consumption flat. Now, our population has stayed relatively flat, but they've put in measures to try to force the energy industry and the consumption to stay flat. And I think because of the geopolitical world we live in and countries have their own boundaries and laws, it would behoove all of us to just be mindful and to try to implement flattening of the consumption, because if we don't, you see what's happening. Yeah, go ahead.
I think that's again political, so you know that
you do. It's a good question.
So why should I stay flat here when the U.S. is consuming 5 times more? So I wouldn't go there for this talk.
Yeah.
It's not necessary.
Okay, all right. I appreciate that very much.
Yeah.
That's good. And this is good. This is how you change the world, by dialogue like this. Yeah.
Can I have a very quick question?
Yes.
Oh, hi. Okay.
Oh, hi, Z.
For your inspiring talk.
Thank you.
It's a gift.
Oh, thank you. many thanks, Ted, for your very inspiring and talk and very informative as well. I'm just curious, there are quite a lot of other energy harvesting algorithm techniques developed, discussed in our community. And even they also discussing about linear, nonlinear model for energy harvesting. So basically, this is another way, like your waste factor theory, for basically to optimize the energy efficiency. So energy harvesting is another way to look at the thing, basically talking about recycling, just like a cognitive radio for spectrum. So I'm just wondering whether your model also can work well with energy harvesting and the technology.
That's a great idea. I've not looked at that. This is pretty new, but that could be a great idea. Energy harvesting and the efficiency of energy harvesting could be measured with waste factor. I believe it could be. Thank you. Okay. Thank you very much. Appreciate it.